You're listening to Sustainably Geeky, the podcast for everyday environmentalists.
Hi, you're listening to Sustainably Geeky, episode 95. I'm your host, Jennifer, and as a reminder, you can support the show on buymeacoffee.com if you're so inclined, or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Today, we're going to be talking to Bruce Friedrich, president and founder of the Good Food Institute, about his recent book, Meat, How the Next Agricultural Revolution Will Transform Humanity's Favorite Food and Our Future. The book offers a hopeful and rigorously researched exploration of how science, policy, and industry can work together to satisfy the world's soaring demand for meat while building a healthier and more sustainable world. So, Bruce, thank you so much for being on the show. I believe you reached out to me on LinkedIn and talked about your book, and I was really intrigued because as an environmentalist, meat is a heavy topic, and full disclosure, I still eat meat. I do eat less meat than I used to, but it is something that I have a lot of feelings over, and I'm sure we'll get into all that, and you talk about that in your book. But I guess before we get into the book and the topic itself, can you start by sharing a bit about your background and what you do at the Good Food Institute?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much, Jennifer, and thank you for having me on the podcast. I'm delighted to be here. So my background, I got interested in food systems really right out of high school. I read a book called Diet for a Small Planet, and it changed the trajectory of my life. I read it right before I was starting my first year of college, and I ended up being so taken by global agriculture and what global agricultural systems and agricultural economics were doing to the global poor, this kind of neo-colonial relationship where developing economies are oftentimes used for their resources in ways whereby consuming something as inefficient as meat ends up actually driving up land prices, driving up food prices. And I spent a year at the London School of Economics studying these relationships. I wrote my senior thesis on structural adjustment programs, which dives into that concept essentially. I ran a homeless shelter and a soup kitchen in inner city Washington, D.C. for about 6 years. I did Teach for America in inner city Baltimore. So teaching in some of the poorest and most sort of forgotten inner city schools for a couple of years. I worked in animal protection for quite a while, and I started the Good Food Institute about 10 and a half years ago. We actually just started hiring staff in June of 2016. So 10 years ago this month, as we are recording.
Yeah. And so what do you all do at the Good Food Institute? I know we talked to one of your colleagues a few years ago, Dr. Elliot Swartz, who is one of your scientists there. And that's a whole other topic about our discussion of cultivated meat and alternative to regular meat. So can you just talk about like what the Institute does?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Good Food Institute, we're basically a science think tank. We're completely nonprofit. So we're supported by donations just like any other nonprofit organization. There are six Good Food Institutes actually. So we have GFI in the US, which is kind of the mothership. Then we have GFI India, Israel, Brazil, Asia Pacific, and Europe. The plurality of our team members around the world are scientists. And what we're doing is building a global scientific ecosystem that is focused on figuring out how do we replicate the precise animal meat experience using plants, but at a lower cost. That's half of it. And then the other half of it is how do we grow actual animal meat, but without the need for live animals. So just like you can take a seed or a cutting from a plant, bathe it in nutrients and grow a whole plant, you can take a small amount of animal muscle or animal fat, bathe that muscle or fat in nutrients and grow basically unlimited additional animal muscle and animal fat. So it would involve, instead of the vast inefficiency of growing crops to feed them to animals so that we can eat animals, you would actually just feed the animal muscle or animal fat directly in something that looks like a brewery. So it's essentially a meat brewery. And it's far more efficient, doesn't require antimicrobial drugs, doesn't contribute to pandemic risk or animal cruelty, requires a fraction of the land, a fraction of the water, a fraction of the pesticides and herbicides, just a far more efficient way of producing meat. So just like most environmental groups are working on energy transition, we're working on protein transition.
Yeah, so you're basically bypassing the whole need for the entire animal to be grown and fed all this, you know, this input, like you said, and just going straight for the parts that are edible and not wasting the rest. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. And it's actually a little bit more than that, because just like you and I probably are not gaining weight and haven't gained weight in a while, and we eat however many thousands of calories every single day. And we need those calories just to survive. So that's going to be true of farm animals as well. So it's not just that when you're feeding a chicken or a pig or a fish, you're growing a bunch of stuff that you're not going to consume, but it's also the vast majority of the energy, the calories that you feed to them, they expend simply existing. So the animal that is most efficient at turning crops into meat is the chicken. And it takes 9 calories into a chicken to get 1 calorie back out. So that's essentially 800% food waste. So 9 times the land, 9 times the water, 9 times the pesticides and herbicides. And it's not just that. You grow all those crops. You have to ship them to a feed mill, operate the feed mill, ship the feed to the farm, operate the farm, ship the animals to the slaughterhouse, operate the slaughterhouse. It's like multiple extra stages of gas guzzling, pollution spewing vehicles, multiple extra factories, which are both energy intensive and polluting, you know, industrial farms, industrial slaughterhouses, really bad for water pollution in surrounding areas, as well as air pollution, as well as climate change. So it's a much more efficient and less harmful way of making actual animal meat.
Yeah. So at GFI, you're focused on researching ways to produce meat more efficiently, whether it's animal meat or plant-based meat. So in the course of doing all this work, what made you say, hey, I want to write a book about this now?
I mean, there are sort of two competing narratives, and I wanted to counter both of them and basically share what is actually true about where we are on the science and innovation trajectory, that, you know, what's going to be necessary to get us to plant-based meat that people actually like, that's indistinguishable from animal meat, but at a lower price. And then similarly, the cultivated meat is already indistinguishable from animal meat, but it's nowhere near being a lower price. So what's going to be required to get it to a lower price? And one of the narratives that some people have is that this is inevitable and there's no room or need for a nonprofit organization. The private sector has it covered. Why bother? That is less true now. That was the dominant narrative, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, sort of the height of the enthusiasm for companies like Impossible and Beyond and Upside Foods, which was then Memphis Meats. And now the more common narrative, also wrong, is that either of these technologies has failed. So the fact that people are not lining up to buy the plant-based meats causes some people to believe they will never line up to buy the plant-based meats. The fact that most of the plant-based meats are not very good, all of them are too expensive, people assume that that means the endeavor has failed. And in the book, I address that head on and point out that no technology emerges fully formed, and talk about a bunch of other technologies that struggled until they hit the S-curve of adoption by satisfying what consumers needed in those technologies. Here, I suggest that's going to be taste parity and price parity for plant-based meat. And then cultivated meat, basically the same thing. A lot of people, you know, people will say, you know, $3 billion has been invested in cultivated meat, and it has not yet panned out, without really thinking about how little that is in sort of the annals of innovation. $3 billion is less than the cost of one EV battery factory. $3 billion is less than the cost of bringing 2 drugs to market if you've already got a $30 billion pharmaceutical company. So that's just the variable costs of bringing 2 drugs to market. That $3 billion has been spread over about 150 cultivated meat companies and all of their existence, which is about 10 and a half years ago that the first cultivated meat company was formed. So I dive into and compare plant-based meat and cultivated meat, their innovation trajectories to a variety of other innovation trajectories, including for a climate audience, maybe most interestingly, the trajectories of things like solar and electric vehicles.
Yeah, I mean, I thought I knew quite a bit about meat as it related to the climate and health and everything like that. But the book is very in depth. More so, you know, I learned so much about just a lot of the things you've already mentioned and some that we'll get into, but what goes into creating plant-based meats and the fact that, you know, my mindset has always kind of been like most people, like, this is just how it is. You know, if you're going to eat plant-based meat, it's just not going to taste like regular meat and you just got to accept it and eat it for what it is. But, you know, learning that, yeah, actually maybe it could get better and there are people researching this was really interesting. So, so in the book, you start out by stating, this book is not about meat at the micro level. In other words, what you choose to eat. This book is about meat at the macro level, how meat is made and how it can be better. So what do you mean by making meat better? You kind of already got into it there, but can you expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, that making meat better is pretty broad. So chapters 1 through 4 are about meats. Contribution, the way that we make meat today, the inefficiency contributes to hunger and malnutrition. It contributes to the range of environmental issues. Number one cause of biodiversity loss, number one cause of deforestation, top cause of air pollution, top cause of climate change, and kind of that full range. That's chapter 2. Chapter 3 is about making meat as a contributor to antimicrobial resistance. Chapter 4 is a contributor to pandemic risk. So those are sort of the external costs of meat production. And then there's also a making meat better in terms of the value to the global economy of this kind of innovation, the value to governments and corporations of this far less fragile supply chain and way of making meat, which is going to be good for governments' food self-sufficiency. And then finally, it's just better meat. So plant-based meat is we can, I'm convinced on the basis of talking to a lot of scientists. I started the entire project by reaching out to 25 plant-based meat scientists, 25 cultivated meat scientists, and basically saying, can we make something that's indistinguishable and cheaper? And if your answer is yes, what's it going to take? How much government support? What do we need in terms of government loans for the companies to build out the infrastructure and the manufacturing base? Those sorts of questions. And I dive into those in chapter 11. And what we end up with plant-based meat is something that's indistinguishable, but it's lower in saturated fat. It's lower in fat. It doesn't have any cholesterol. It has some fiber. It's higher in protein. All of the 14 plant-based meats that meat eaters like best, none of them are quite at parity yet, but we've only just started. But the ones that meat eaters like best, all 14 of them are higher in protein than the animal meat that they're replacing. And they don't have the bacterial contamination. They don't have the drug residues. So the E. coli, salmonella, campylobacter, listeria. If they're seafood, they don't have the microplastics or the mercury or the dioxins. So it's, you know, it's literally better, safer, cleaner meat. And then it also doesn't have those external costs. And it does have the benefits around food security and economic growth. So making meat better. We've been making meat in the same way for 12,000 years, cycling crops through animals. We can do significantly better across basically all of the variables that exist.
Yeah. What do you say to the folks who hear that and say, well, it's just not natural. Like meat should just be grown the way it's always been grown. And as an animal out in the field, whatever, how do you respond to that argument, even though it's technically the way we do it now probably isn't natural because we are pumping them full of drugs and speeding up their life cycles, et cetera, et cetera. But
yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sympathetic to people who either A, want to hunt animals for meat. That feels like a sort of how it's always been done. And I think you bypass most, if not all, of the concerns other than animal welfare, but hunting is certainly a heck of a lot better for animal welfare than industrial animal farms and industrial animal slaughterhouses. And then in the book, I'm explicitly sympathetic to regenerative animal farming and agroecological practices. Although I do point out that those practices require a heck of a lot more land, are a lot more resource intensive. And one of the great things about plant-based and cultivated meat is that they require, if you're talking about chicken, between a fourth to a sixth of the land requirement. If you're talking about beef, between a 10th and a 20th of the land requirement. So if industrial animal meat is produced using plant-based meat and cultivated meat, that frees up an awful lot of land for regenerative and agroecological practices, which require a lot more land. But what they're replacing, industrial animal meat, I think you just sort of nodded at it. There's nothing natural about cramming 50,000 chickens in a shed and keeping them drugged up on antibiotics for their entire lives so that they don't have massive death losses. Like, that's insanely unnatural, which is why the USDA and the FDA, they have 100 different veterinary drugs that they consider to be acceptable at trace amounts in meat. And I think most meat eaters probably would rather have like no ractopamine or ivermectin in their meat. But FDA and USDA, they beg to differ. That's just fine according to their regulations. So I think if people look at how meat is produced today, they will agree that it's incredibly unnatural, the vast majority of it. And this is a pretty big upgrade.
Yeah, and that leads into my next question. Like, I know a big segment that of the arguments against meat consumption are the environmental damage and, of course, the welfare of the animals themselves. And there's that whole piece of zoonotic disease spreading and also antibiotic use. That was a huge eye-opener for me when I was reading the book. I mean, I kind of had an idea about it, but you broke it down a bit. And, you know, as you said, the pathogens that are in the meat that go to the consumer that are considered okay, and then we have to basically char the meat within an inch of its life just to kill all the stuff that's in it. Can you kind of talk about that, the threats to human health from modern meat production? Because I think maybe a lot of folks also didn't know about a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, according to the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, it's literally millions of people getting sick from contaminated meat every single year, from Salmonella, Campylobacter, Listeria, E. coli. It's more than 100,000 hospitalizations. It's thousands of deaths. And if you go to the CDC and look at their recommendations for like how to basically, cook meat and washing all of your appliances and your surfaces and everything, you kind of have to treat your kitchen like a biohazard lab. Obviously, with plant-based meat or cultivated meat, because there is no intestinal tract on the animals involved, you can say goodbye to all of those problems. The sort of bigger long-term problems, the two that get entire chapters unto themselves in the book, are antimicrobial resistance and pandemic risk. Antimicrobial resistance stems from the fact that about 70% of medically relevant antibiotics that are produced by the global pharmaceutical industry, so these are human medicines, and 70% of them are used in farm animals. Not because the farm animals are sick, they're used prophylactically because, as I sort of nodded at a minute ago, if you cram 50,000 chickens in a shed, all cooped in their own excrement, barely able to move, that's a disease breeding, perfect conditions. But if you drug the animals up, if you give them subtherapeutic antibiotics for their entire lives, you can take death losses from, I don't know what they would be otherwise, probably north of 50%. Down to 4 to 5%. And that makes those conditions, livable for most of the animals. But what it also does is it creates superbugs that are currently killing about 1.3 million people a year. They're expected to be killing 10 million people a year by 2050. And this is a direct result of dosing farm animals with these subtherapeutic doses of antibiotics. And then the bacteria mutate. They figure to get around how to get around the antibiotics. And then your doctor prescribes antibiotics to you, and those antibiotics don't work. It's the number one cause. I devote an entire chapter to it. The UK government says the threat to the human race from antibiotic resistance is greater than the threat from climate change. And then chapter four is about pandemic risk. So the UN Environment Program and the International Livestock Research Institute, they put together a report preventing the next pandemic in July of 2020. They convened 18 of the world's leading zoonotic disease experts, and their list of the seven most likely causes of the next pandemic. The first one is increased meat consumption, and the second one is the industrial treatment of animals. So increased meat consumption. We're currently globally eating about 80 billion land animals per year. Every one of those animals is a potential vector for the next pandemic. And that number just keeps going up. So that's number one. And then number two is the industrial treatment of animals. Again, because if you cram 50,000 chickens in a shed and they are all so genetically similar, which is true for industrial farms today, that again creates basically a breeding ground for the next pandemic. And COVID-19 was not particularly lethal. It was not particularly transmissible. And yet it still sent an extra more than 100 million people into dire poverty. It set back poverty alleviation efforts by about a decade. The next pandemic could be far, far worse.
Yeah, and reports come out about COVID-19 potentially starting in like bushmeat or crossover from parts of the world that hadn't really had much contact with humans. And then farm animals kind of came into contact with other animals that maybe were in the jungle or something. And a lot of pandemics start this way, right? And I mean, just look at what's happening in the US right now, all the things that are coming back in the last few years. It's very scary time.
And if you Google like New York Times and avian influenza, it's interesting. The stories don't get that much pickup, but the Times has been great about covering the issue. And we are finding that the latest bird flus, they're jumping into cattle, they're infecting dairy cattle, they're infecting humans, they're also infecting all kinds of wild animals. And that's all starting on industrial animal farms. And it's getting worse and it's getting more transmissible. And you know, in the book, I create a metaphor about a powder keg that's about to blow. And the response of the experts is not to disarm the powder keg. The response of the experts is to wait for it to blow and then figure out how we're going to deal with basically the center of town on fire.
Yeah, sounds great. What could go wrong? like the human health impacts, I was really blown away by especially the antibiotic stuff, because you always hear about that risk from just taking antibiotics, and every time you take it you might be becoming less resistant, and so I was just thinking about it from the perspective of like, what have I been exposed to directly? But I wasn't thinking through the meat that I eat. Like, I've never thought of it that way, and that's crazy that we're doubling our chances of getting resistant bugs by putting it so much in the animals.
It's interesting, because you're taking antibiotics is an infinitesimally small part of the problem. So you have this sort of collective, the tragedy of the commons, where what causes antibiotic resistance is sort of the overall overprescription to en masse. Like, that is a contributor, but you're not doing anything to your personal immune system or whatever with regard to taking antibiotics. You're a tiny part of allowing the bugs to figure out how to mutate and beat the drugs that we've got to kill them. Yeah. But it's significantly greater what's happening in farm animals. Again, it's 70% of the global antibiotic supply, medically relevant global antibiotic supply. It's even more non-medically relevant, which could be just as bad. We don't know for sure. And it's the number one cause. The World Health Organization has been screaming about it since at least the late 1990s. Scientists have been publishing saying this is going to create antibiotic superbugs literally since the 1950s in top medical journals. And yet the problem just gets worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, another thing to add to our list of existential crises happening these days.
This is one where plant-based meat and cultivated meat could literally solve it. They don't require antibiotics. So 70% of antibiotics if we switched in this direction. And this is one where regenerative agriculture, agroecological practices, those animals also don't get antibiotics. So switching in that direction is also really helpful.
Yeah, I want to go back to something you mentioned at the beginning there about the reasons we have to cook meat the way we do and handle it like it's a nuclear waste or something in our kitchen. Am I understanding correctly that if we didn't have meat produced in this way, that if it was grown in a lab or plant-based, we'd still have to cook it, obviously, but maybe we wouldn't have to be so careful of like sanitizing until it's completely 100% bleach, whatever, every surface. And basically, we could be a little more lax, or we wouldn't have to use as many chemicals, or am I just wishful thinking?
Yeah, I mean, it would be that, you know, you'd have to treat it with sort of the same attention that you give to canned beans or something like that. You know, vastly, incredibly unlikely to actually cause you harm. And you certainly don't need to worry that much about, well, you don't have to worry at all about washing surfaces, et cetera, unless you like set them out for like 3 days or something. But yeah, I mean, it's the digestive tracts of the animal. I mean, E. coli is literally manure, you know, it's literally animal crap. But with plant-based meat and cultivated meat, no digestive tract.
Wow.
Consequently, all of the principal harms that lead to food poisoning, they go away.
Yeah, that, I mean, that could revolutionize how restaurants operate, because so much of food prep is separating things, making sure they're extra clean. Like, I worked in a restaurant, we were very adamant about, you can't have food next to this, next to that, this kind of food, and everything has to be refrigerated at this level. And that could just really change the game there and make things easier, I'd say.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. It's a huge benefit, even just in terms of that like immediate food safety concerns.
Yeah. Ugh, geez, so much to learn here. So you've kind of touched on this already, but can you talk a little bit more about the environmental cost of food production or meat production, and just why is it bad for the environment? We always hear this, but, you know, why would cutting meat actually help the climate and biodiversity, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned a little bit ago the just like vast inefficiency of cycling crops through animals, and the fact that it takes 9 calories in to get 1 calorie out. What that means is you need 9 times the water, 9 times the land, 9 times the pesticides and herbicides and all of that, all those extra stages of production that I talked about. When the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, they crunched the numbers, they wrote a more than 400-page report called Livestock's Long Shadow. They said, whatever environmental issue you're looking at, from the smallest and most local to the largest and most global, animal agriculture, that inefficiency of growing crops to feed them to animals, all those extra stages of production, it makes it one of the top 3 causes. So that's water use and water pollution, biodiversity loss and deforestation, soil erosion, climate change, the full range. And the thing about that is that that report came out 20 years ago. It came out in 2006. We are now eating globally another 105 million metric tons of meat, 40% more meat than we were when that report came out. And one of the things that that report said was that 14.5% of all climate emissions are attributable to animal agriculture. That's more than all of the cars, the planes, the trucks, all forms of transportation combined. And it just keeps going up. The World Resources Institute, they did an analysis and they said, on the basis of meat's current upward trajectory, in the year 2050, there will literally be no wild spaces left. There will be no more forests. There will be no more savannas. There will be no more wild spaces. The number one source of biodiversity loss and deforestation, because raising animals for food requires so much land, either to graze ruminants or to grow crops to feed them to farm animals. The vast majority of agricultural land, about 3 billion hectares right now, is attributable to animal agriculture. It's about 80% of all agricultural land. That is the size of China plus India times 2 plus Indonesia. That's how much land is required. And WRI says we're going to double that by 2050 on our current trajectory. So it's linked to, you know, the full range of environmental issues. And the numbers have been crunched by some McKinsey economists, also some economists at the International Institute of Applied Systems Analysis. And what they found was that a 10% shift toward plant-based and cultivated meat would mitigate about 1 billion tons of CO2 equivalent, which is the same as simply eliminating air travel. So air travel is responsible for about 1 gigaton, about 1 billion tons of CO2 equivalent. 10% adoption of alternative proteins is the equivalent of that. 20% adoption is the equivalent of every single car, bus, and light truck on the planet shifts to electric. That's the equivalent of a 20% adoption. So the climate dividends, the land dividends, the biodiversity dividends, the water security and water pollution dividends of shifting in this direction are just absolutely massive.
Yeah, and you hear horror stories of places where, like, the waste from these animals, the runoff from that, yeah, ends up in the water supply. And usually it's the populations that are the most vulnerable already that are the brunt of all of this. And on top of that, they're dealing with all the other issues I've already mentioned. So it's really a lot.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The environmental racism of where the farms and where the slaughterhouses are placed. I mean, it's very, very real.
Yeah. So obviously there's health risks, environmental risks, all these things that we've talked about. But for those people who aren't convinced by all that, and they say, you know, I still want to eat meat. It's whatever. What are the economic and security arguments against meat? Because turns out there's also risks there.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing, this is where GFI really focuses. So I mentioned earlier, we have about 250 staff, the plurality of our team members all over the world. Are scientists. We're a science think tank. Our organizational global battle cry is that governments should be funding the science and governments should be incentivizing the manufacturing and the infrastructure scale up. And our arguments to governments don't involve all of the stuff we've been talking about so far. You know, some government officials care about meat's contribution to those things. But it is completely bipartisan to want your country to have a strong economic base, to maximize your GDP, to ensure that you have food self-sufficiency and food security. And all of Chapter 9 of the book is about the economic benefits of shifting in this direction. All of the reasons that making meat the way that it's made right now, all of those inefficiency reasons, all of those environmental harm reasons, are also massive economic opportunity reasons. The meat industry is a $2 trillion global industry, meat and seafood. So that is a lot of money that is on the table if we can figure out how to make meat less expensively. And the efficiency gains of shifting in this direction mean making meat less expensively. So that's a big incentive for governments. And then Chapter 10 is about food self-sufficiency, food security, food systems resilience. Again, the inefficiency, all those extra stages of production, you know, the growing the crops, shipping the crops, feed mills, farms, slaughterhouses, that is incredible fragility. It is also incredible susceptibility to agroterrorism. These are points that the Center for Strategic and International Studies, one of the top think tanks in the world, oftentimes number one on lists of national security think tanks, they produced a 5,000-word report that makes the case that the U.S. government should be leaning in on alternative meats in the same way it leans in on advanced chips for AI and biopharma. And it's talking about agroterrorism, food self-sufficiency, food security, the incredible fragility of our current food production system, kind of all of this stuff means from their perspective that we should be shifting in this new and better direction. They also make the case, which allows these issues to be bipartisan, that China is leaning in with both their biotechnology and their biomanufacturing on plant-based and cultivated meat. So 11 Republican members of Congress, and I tell this story in the book, 11 Republican members of Congress wrote to the Director of National Intelligence, the Director of Homeland Security, and basically said, we do not want China to dominate the future of meat production. The U.S. government needs to lean in on this as well.
So dare I ask, what is the current state of that under the current administration? Is there a focus on it? Has it been just ignored, or are we actually, you know, making progress in the U.S. and maybe around the world even?
I mean, we're definitely making progress both in the U.S. and around the world. So, you know, literally 6 years ago, there was no government funding for these technologies. Singapore was doing a little bit of incentivizing of startups. Israel was doing a little bit of incentivizing of the startups. And in the last 6 years, we now see more than 30 governments, hundreds of millions of pounds putting into this in the UK, South Korea, the Netherlands, Denmark, a lot of other countries are leaning in on these technologies, and none of them are doing it for any of the sort of meat is bad for the environment or bad for global health or bad for the global poor or bad for animals. They're all doing it for the economic benefits and the food security benefits. And we are making significant progress. And one of the things that the 11 Republican members of Congress point out is that of the 20 most active patent applicants globally, 8 of them are in China, 3 in the US, 3 in Israel, 3 in South Korea, 8 of them are in China. And they say, you know, basically, do we want China to dominate global food? No, we don't. And obviously, that's a strong bipartisan concern. The foreword of my book was actually written by somebody who was in both the Obama administration at the Department of State, and then almost all of the first Trump administration at the National Security Council. Her name is Caitlin Welsh. She left the Trump administration to launch the Global Food and Water Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And she wrote the foreword to the book and just said, you know, this is a national security issue. It's a food and water security issue. Those are national security issues. And this book needs to be taken seriously by policymakers.
Well, and I'm always one to say it doesn't matter how we get there, as long as other things align to help the environmental things move forward, then I'm fine to say, yeah, let's go, because it's good that these interests line up, and maybe they're not doing it for the same reasons as other people, but if we all have the same goal, then I think it's a good thing.
Yep, I agree.
So can you talk about what do you think is preventing plant-based and cultivated meats from being more widely adopted by consumers? I know we've talked a little bit about the production side of it, but you know, what do you think the resistance is by the consumers?
Yeah, I mean, the theory has always been that they need to compete on price and taste. They need to be equally delicious, and they need to be the same price or less. And that's kind of what all of Chapter 5 is about. It's a deep dive into what it's going to take to get consumers on board. And this is similar to if you're looking at the trajectory of electric vehicles. The cars are going to need to go more than 120 kilometers, which is about how far they went 10 years ago. They need to cost less. They need to be competitive with conventional gas-powered cars. And there needs to be a charging infrastructure. And most people are not going to buy an electric car until all three of those things are true, are solved for. The same thing is true here. The products are going to need to compete on price, and they are going to need to compete on taste. And that's why GFI sees this as principally a science and innovation challenge right now. And we're not that worried about low consumption rates when the products don't compete on price or taste. 10 years ago, electric vehicles globally had not hit 1%. They hit 1% in 2017. Now they're about 24% globally. They hit 1% in China in 2015. They're now over 50% in China. And that's because the cars, their battery range is getting better, the price is coming down, a charging infrastructure is being developed. And that's when they can shoot up the S-curve. That's basically what needs to happen here, except the prices need to come down and the products need to get better. And that's what we're focused on.
Yeah, one of the things that stood out the most for me in reading the book was you talked about how there's been decades of education and advocacy efforts talking about the benefits of a plant-based diet and how meat consumption has actually increased around the world in spite of that. So when people say, just eat less meat because it's better for you, like that isn't working for people, just telling them that. And like you said, some people just like the taste of meat and they'll never give that up because it is, I don't know if it's like a primal thing in us in humans, but we are hardwired, some people would say, to eat meat. And even reducing consumption, no matter how much information you give them, it's hard. So I think there's a cultural importance when it comes to food. And there's also the question of access, because you can tell people all day long, don't eat that. But if the thing costs twice as much that was better for the environment and maybe healthier, like some people just don't have that option. So yeah, in other words, I guess there's some people we'll never reach with the same old arguments, and we can either keep trying to convert those people, or we can try to do what you're saying, produce it more sustainably and ethically. And then in the process, maybe we'll get those people. If it tastes like meat, then maybe they'll eat it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think it's very similar. Like, most people are not going to install solar panels on their house. Most people are not going to buy an electric vehicle because it has environmental benefits. Mm-hmm. They're going to have solar when the grid is integrated with solar. People are going to buy an electric vehicle when it is actually a better car and equally convenient. And we do have the better product. The plant-based meat is healthier, higher in protein, safer. Cultivated meat is literally the exact same thing, except it's a lot cleaner and safer. So we've got the better product down, and we just need to get the price and taste down. And there really is not anything more clear in agricultural economics, or maybe even economics writ large, than that as GDP goes up, meat consumption per capita goes up. Everybody agrees that this is going to continue to be the case. Since 1961, which is the year that the UN Food and Agriculture Organization started measuring, every single year since 1961, total meat consumption has gone up. And that is going to continue through 2050, absent, you know, some sort of catastrophe or massive economic collapse or something like that. So the solution cannot be, let's just keep doing exactly what we've been doing, begging people to eat less meat. Like, that's fine. Education is fine. It's important. It's why I'm here and have changed my diet. It's why most of the people who started these companies have changed their diets. It's valuable. In the same way that more energy efficient light bulbs and buildings and everything else are valuable, and public transit and bike lanes and walkable cities, all of that is valuable. But at the end of the day, we do need renewable energy to replace fossil fuels. We do need electric vehicles to replace gas powered cars. And we do need these alternative meats, plant-based meat and cultivated meat, if we're going to address the massive environmental and other harms of the way that we make meat today. There really are just the two options. Convince people to consume less. That's what we've been trying to do for more than 50 years, and meat consumption just keeps going up. And this. So this is an essential tool in the toolkit.
Yeah, it seems like there's just, it's like meat is a signifier of we've made it, right? When you think about back decades ago, you wouldn't eat meat, but maybe once a week, maybe one meal a day if you were lucky, but you didn't have meat every single meal like people do today. And a lot of that was a function of money and cost, but also that you just couldn't produce it on that scale. And now that we can, it's just, it's cheaper, it's easier to get, but we're seeing other problems, health problems, et cetera. So it's just an interesting, yeah, how some countries that still don't eat a lot of meat, there's reasons for that.
Even those countries are seeing skyrocketing meat consumption. I mean, meat consumption in India is up 300% in the last 20 years. So it's nowhere near meat consumption in the U.S. or meat consumption in the West, but it's going up every single year, and it's going up by a higher percentage every single year, maybe than anywhere else in the world. And that's really just economic growth. India is sort of an economic miracle in the same way that China is an economic miracle. And that's been really bad for China's food self-sufficiency. When they joined the WTO 25 years ago, their food self-sufficiency ratio was 100%. Now it's down about 65%, and it's going down every year. That's the reason that President Xi and the Chinese government are enthusiastic about plant-based meat and cultivated meat, because their food self-sufficiency ratios can start going back in the other direction if they lean in on these technologies. But yeah, I mean, meat consumption, it just keeps going up. It's going to just keep going up. And this is really the only thing that might make a dent in meat's external costs.
Yeah, if you can't get people to change their behavior, then change how it's made. Like, it makes sense to me. And I consider myself a pretty staunch environmentalist, but I have trouble completely giving up meat for a lot of reasons. A lot of it is access and just affordability. But yeah, not just a, oh, stop doing it kind of thing. People aren't doing it always to be evil either. Sometimes it's just added chore, changing your diet when you're already overstretched, you know, running around, working three jobs, whatever. There could be tons of reasons for it. So.
Yeah, I talk about the book Thinking Fast and Slow by the Nobel laureate in economics, Daniel Kahneman, which is one of the most interesting books I think that's ever been written. And he talks about systems one and systems two thinking. And systems one thinking basically is everything at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, all the sort of physiological stuff. And there's just example after example after example of the degree to which our actual food motivations are different from what we think our food motivations are. And that's why in sort of the pre-weight loss drugs in the world, you know, pre-weight loss drugs, people just kept getting heavier and heavier and heavier and heavier, not because of lack of willpower, not because people didn't, you know, want to be a healthy weight or whatever. It's just like, food motivations are very much our reptilian brain, and food motivations are super instinctual. And food motivations, they go toward things that are high in fat, high in salt, high in sugar, high in caloric density. And meat is, you know, that's certainly high in caloric density, high in fat, really concentrated proteins, concentrated calories, and it's just like super craveable.
Yeah. What did you say in the title? It's humanity's favorite food. So yeah, it's not just as cut and dry as just stop doing it.
It doesn't work for most people in the same way that, you know, consume right. less energy. Just doesn't work for most people. It's not how our bodies are programmed.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I know we've covered a lot in this last 45 or so minutes, but is there anything we haven't touched on that you would like to talk about now?
Yeah, I mean, for people who want to dive into the book, it does have a website, which is just neatbook.org. So I encourage people to check it out. I was gratified that Publishers Weekly named it one of the top 10 new releases in science. Nature magazine picked it as a top 5 science pick. So if people check it out, I would welcome anybody's feedback.
Great. And I'm assuming it's available digitally, or is it on audiobook, and is it available internationally as well?
It is available on ebook, and as a print edition and as Audible. Mm-hmm. I think if you want to get it in most places internationally, you need to VPN, and head to Amazon or Barnes and Noble or whatever, and download the ebook or download the audiobook.
All right. Well, if there are any other, I had one more question for you. Sorry. How can our listeners advocate for the growth of the alt meat industry and the work that you all are doing?
Well, that's the conclusion of the book, is my extensive career advice, which is going to be very case by case, based on what people's skill sets are. Although I will say, as I mentioned earlier, GFI is a nonprofit organization. There's a charity evaluator called Giving Green that was founded by a guy named Dan Stein, who was an LSE trained development economist. He worked at the World Bank for a bunch of years. Then he went and worked as chief economist for an organization called ID Insight, basically in evaluating the impact and the outcomes of global development projects. And he started a climate charity evaluator to dive in and basically make sure, or basically find out, what are the climate charities that deliver the highest bang for the buck. So they did a deep dive into how we evaluate our impact and outcomes, the degree to which we change in the face of results. So do we lean in on the things that are working and lean out of the things that aren't working? How is our management? How is our oversight? Kind of all of that. And they have selected us as a top 5 charity for people who care about the climate for the last 5 years in a row, all 5 years that we've been evaluated. People can find their evaluation on the Giving Green website. So donating to GFI, if you're philanthropic, is one option. And then I talk about journalism and students and academics and a variety of other ways that people can dive in and get involved. People who want to follow the industry are our website, the Good Food Institute, so just gfi.org. And if you want to see the various newsletters that we put out, gfi.org/newsletters.
Perfect. And yeah, I'm assuming the normal things like, you know, reaching out to your representatives and senators and anybody that might be able to influence policy in this area as well, if there's a law or something, a regulation in question.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially if you have a Republican representative or a Republican senator. We do very well with Republicans, but it's definitely people who are in districts of Republican representatives and Republican senators. If that is you and you are enthusiastic to get deeply involved, please reach out to me and I will put you in touch with our policy team, and they can get you briefing papers and work with you.
Yeah, that's great. Well, are there any other resources you'd share with listeners in this area that want to learn more?
I mean, the GFI.org website is pretty all-encompassing. And then for the book, meetbook.org. And if you want to see some of the reviews, meetbook.org/praise.
Well, I guess we'll move on now to our green life hack portion of the show. This is where we share one thing each, or in your case, you said you had two, a bonus for folks who want to live more sustainably and get started on their sustainability journey if you're feeling overwhelmed. So Bruce, do you want to start us out?
Sure. I mean, I travel a lot, and most people who travel a lot, in my experience, end up spending a lot of time taking Lyft and Uber. I have discovered the joys of e-scooters, especially during like climate week in New York City. You can get around so much more quickly on an e-scooter or an e-bike. Mm-hmm. A Lime subscription, L-I-M-E, is just $5 a month. And suddenly all of your Limes are just like a couple dollars for each ride. It's so incredibly, I don't know, I absolutely love it. It's also just a ton of fun to be scooting around on an e-scooter or an e-bike. And then the other one that I'm just really surprised by how many people haven't picked up on is how great Google Maps and Apple Maps are for public transit. So it's just so, it's like really interesting to me that I will visit somebody in Austin or in Denver, and I will show up at their house and I will have taken a bus from the airport, and it will take me to within like less than a 5-minute walk from their house. They have lived there for more than a decade, and they have no idea that they can take a bus to the airport. And so Google Maps and Apple Maps for public transit are absolutely glorious. And then the sort of 2.5 hack is that ChatGPT will tell you in any city whether you can just use your credit card to scan on and off the bus or on and off the metro. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of places now have that. So you don't even need to like queue up and get a car, you know, get a metro card that you're inevitably going to lose. So
unless you live in Ireland and they still have the Leap card, you have to load the card or you have to have cash, but that's a whole other conversation. It's very frustrating. Yeah.
That was true of Amsterdam up until fairly recently, which I just found it very strange that they were so late to adopt. But yeah, most places will now just take your credit card to scan on and off the bus, to scan on and off metro, et cetera, which is great.
It's so nice because bus anxiety is very real. Like I recently traveled to Belfast and I waited like 2 full days before I used a bus because I was just so nervous about, do I have to have a card? Are they going to, you know, asking a question of the bus driver, you don't want to hold up the queue. And yeah, so that's a very good tip for folks wanting to explore public transit more. And in the US, we are pretty bad about public transit, using it and knowing how to use it.
I was just, we had a book event in Chicago last week, and I was late because of the weather. And I looked at how long it was going to take to like take a Lyft or an Uber or whatever. And it said between 65 and 95 minutes. And I looked at how long it was going to take public transit, and it said 65 minutes. And so I, you know, hopped on public transit, and it took less because I got off public transit, hopped on a Lime scooter for the last, you know, 10 minutes. So I ended up getting there in under an hour. And and people were like, wait, you took public transit from O'Hare? And it was, it's interesting how incredulous even locals can be to that. But it was literally faster than the quickest I could have gotten there on Lyft or Uber. And it was like way less stressful to take the metro and then scooter.
Yes. Nothing better than being able to take the train or the bus from the airport, not have to deal with driving and parking and all that stuff. So I definitely concur there. My green life hack is it's kind of cheating because the whole episode's been about meat and different ways of eating meat or eating less meat. And I would just challenge folks to either think of a dish you normally cook yourself and try to make it meatless or adapt it in some way that it's more vegetarian. Or if you go out to eat, maybe opt for the vegetarian option instead. A lot of times I would gravitate towards the chicken or the burger or the whatever. And you know, sometimes I'll try the veggie curry or whatever interesting dish they've made at that restaurant, just to kind of mix things up and also eat less meat that way. I know we can't always give it up entirely, but maybe take one or two meals a day or even a whole day a week and make it meatless Monday or whatever you want to call it. But just try to think of creative ways to work in those meatless dishes. And you'll be surprised. Like some days I look back at what I ate and think, oh, I didn't eat meat all day today or yesterday. And I didn't even realize it because I've gotten so used to kind of eating other things. So it is possible to shift your diet and kind of trick your brain into thinking it's eating something else. So yeah, that's my green life hack. Bruce, thanks so much for being on the show. And where can we find you online one more time?
Thank you so much, Jennifer. I really enjoyed chatting with you. And thank you for your podcast focused on sustainability. It's awesome. So people can find me on LinkedIn. Just look up my name or meatbook.org.
Perfect. And we will link to everything we've talked about in the show notes if you want to go back and look at that. You can find the show on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky, YouTube, and anywhere that you listen to podcasts. And we would appreciate your like and subscribe if you're so inclined. Again, we're on buymeacoffee.com. You can find me personally on Instagram and Blue Sky at Het's Gonna Be Me. And for everyone listening, have a great rest of your day.
This has been a presentation of the Epically Geeky Network.